one thing that you talked about was towards the end of your presentation, absent of global shock. What kinds of things might those be, a global shock type of a scenario that may change your forecasting numbers and predictions?
Great question. In the past, we've worried about a global energy shock. So if we look at the last 50 years, we've been to war, we've had recessions as a consequence of global energy shock. U.S. is now producing record-level petroleum, natural gas. We're the world's biggest exporter of those commodities. And so that's less of a concern. What concerns me right now are shocks, a major war. A minor war like what we're seeing at the coast of Yemen could disrupt supply chains, drive up costs for some industries. Most of the transit across that area are parts that go into making automobiles in Europe or manufacture goods here in the United States. So any shock to a global supply chain has impacts around the globe. So that's sort of the worry that we have. For me, the sort of thing that would knock us off a real growth path would be Russian defeat of Ukraine, an invasion of Poland, which requires an Article 5 movement by the United States and everywhere into NATO, a broader expansion of war in the Middle East surrounding Israel and Palestine that does interrupt enough oil or petroleum products to cause big shocks to commodity prices. And then obviously, conflict in Taiwan would be global recession, global depression level shock, as it involves so many countries in war. So those are the things you always worry about from its most modest, you know, supply chain interruption that the United States Navy is preventing right now, all the way thing up to the things the Senator spoke about, us maintaining our defense posture that prevents war rather than allowing it to spill over in the places where it's happening right now.
You talked about how Indiana's economy is very reactive to manufacturing. Senator Young was talking about technological manufacturing, like semiconductors in southern Indiana. Is that industry where it's more tech-heavy manufacturing, is that as volatile or about the same?
Oh, great question. No, the tech industries, particularly those that we've been focusing on with the CHIPS Act, are going to be less interest rate sensitive. They're going to be more diverse in the sense that they're providing inputs to far more and everything from microcomputer chips to the cameras that you have here. So that's going to, those are not nearly as interest rate sensitive as, say, automobiles or recreational vehicles or brackets for new housing supply. So that's one benefit, is they're less volatile. The other one is they pay a lot better. Those jobs just pay a lot. They anticipate you had a bachelor's degree or near a bachelor's degree education and training to prepare for those positions, but they pay $100,000 to $130,000 a year for line jobs, and that's a very different type of manufacturing than I think most Hoosiers have in their head. So if we were to see a substantial growth in that, which would replace other jobs, and we're not going to see manufacturing employment growth, what we're going to see is those jobs replacing more traditional factory jobs. That would make Indiana both more productive, higher incomes, and more stable over the business cycle.
He read a laundry list of new investments. Do any of those factor in to your first year, or would, even if all of those came online now, would they move the needle?
Yeah, if they came online now, they would. But this is, as he mentioned, we did a study of the CARES Act a year ago out of the center. That study sort of identified the places they would come. In Indiana had 4 out of like 50 U.S. counties where they would be highly probable. And you're seeing the geography a little bit better. We didn't expect Daviess counties. The 500 to 1,000 jobs there is an unexpected hit for us. But, yeah, Indiana has got good places for that to be. Those jobs are better, again, much better than a typical manufacturing job that might pay $45,000 to $60,000 a year. They're more demanding in terms of educational attainment and skills. And they're going to be those types of investments are far more persistent. So the type of technology they use doesn't decay as quickly. It's going to be replaced on site more frequently. And it's going to be more sensitive to the local labor market. So if they decide to come here, once they get people here, they can't up and move somewhere else because that you have to build that labor supply around your factory. So it's not like value-added agriculture. It's not like automobile parts where there's a lot more just business churn. These are going to be more stable businesses. And we see them, we would anticipate when they're built to be in those communities for most of the rest of this century, which is very different than what you'd expect from a 500-person warehouse or a 500-person traditional factory or assembly plant.
He also said, I think, that that your what you said from the stage would be wrong?
Yeah, all forecasts are wrong. All forecasts are wrong. We hope they're useful in the sense that they give us a sense of where, because I gave a point estimate for the next quarter. That's certainly not going to be right. They're almost never right. But what this and where this forecast is I think, a happy forecast in the sense that a year ago I didn't think we were going into recession, and I said so now. I said I thought the Federal Reserve had good tools and a good opportunity to engineer a soft landing. So I think that's where we're at now. This forecast is good because what happened last year wasn't just that we engineered a soft landing. We had productivity growth occur at a very late portion of the business cycle. And what we see when we observe these productivity growth data is that it tends to come, we tend to have big bursts of productivity that can last for years, followed by periods of very somnolent productivity growth. We had a little bit of productivity shock in the last part of the aughts, 2004 to about 2007. We had productivity shock in the last two-thirds of the 1990s. And then we're positive. We've had very slow productivity growth now since about 2007, a historically quiet productivity growth. At the same time, we see all this new innovation, new technology coming everywhere. There's a good possibility it's hitting in a way that we're at the early stages of one of those productivity surges. And what that would mean is higher GDP, faster growth, lower levels of unemployment, higher compensation for workers, all of those good things that spill over. It would mean the budget deficit would shrink, more people are working, paying taxes. It would place fewer demands on public services. So that's the happy position that we're in right now. So this forecast isn't what a year ago I thought, well, we might be at slow growth, and I might be saying, well, we're going to get out of it in a year or two. That's what my forecast for 2024 and 20 said last year. What I'm saying this year is that forecast was really wrong on the downside, that what we're seeing are upside pressures on all forecasts. So the models that I ran yesterday increased growth by more than half a percentage point on average for the next 6 months. And so I think we're in a period where the economy of the next few years might look more like the late 1990s or the mid-1980s than anything we've seen at any other time. And that's as happy a forecast as I've been able to give for the long term since I've been here at Ball State. It's now 17 years.
So last question for me because my arm's tired. So I assume I know the answer, but I want to hear you say it. Which is going to flip the people's mindset or their behavior?
The behavior is not changing. There's no evidence. You go to the airport, you go to Disney World, people are spending, they're buying, and have fairly robust balance sheets. So it's not like households are depleted savings. That's not the case. So it's expectations that are going to change. We see that just yesterday also. Consumer sentiment was up. It's been up over the past 4 or 5 months. So I think I call this great discordance. By this summer, I think people's view of the economy will catch up to where economists think it is. And so that's I think, very good news for the American consumer. It's good for it's good for the overall economy that people are right about where they think they are. How that plays out electorally, I have no idea. But it's always tough because in an election cycle, there's one group that always wants the economy to be thought of to be underperforming. Another group wants to be overperforming. And it's entirely dependent upon who's the incumbent and who's not. So I think right now we're in a period of pretty happy economic conditions that are spilling out not just nationally, as the senator mentioned. Growth has been enormously concentrated in the United States, but we're partly because people now are geographically expanding due to COVID, but also partially because we're seeing, just unemployment rate everywhere very low. If you need workers, you can't just sit in Manhattan and wait for them. You got to go find them wherever they are. And so that's a much better geographic story for those of us who live in the part of the country that has just not enjoyed a stable economic growth for several decades.
Internationally, do you get a sense that, I mean, is this really a U.S. phenomenon, this surge that may be coming our way, or is this something that extends to Europe and Asia?
So the United States economy is outperforming the rest of the globe. But there's reasons why Europe, which generally follows us, may not be following us fully. One is they're far more energy dependent upon Russian petroleum, which has had a lot of shocks. And so they're feeling more pain from the war in Ukraine than we are. They're also spending a lot of money and a lot of political capital trying to focus on that war because it's right at their border. I mean, you can hear the shells from Poland. You can hear the bombing from parts of Poland. And so they're not experiencing it. These types of technologically led productivity growth have been almost entirely absent in China for 40 years. They just have not enjoyed this. And their growth has been due to the relocation of workers from essentially subsistence farms into factories that are about as productive as the United States was a century ago. So that's a subsistence farm is in Northern Europe circa 1650. So people literally, families are producing $300,000 or $400,000 per person per year over the past two or three decades in China. They're being relocated to families where that family is now producing $8,000 to $10,000 per year, which is at, in terms of purchasing power parity, that is the poverty level in the United States for a single person. They've not enjoyed that technological growth. They have individual factories that have great stuff, but it's not bled out over the economy because they don't have a free market system. They don't have a system where if I'm running a factory and I see my buddy's got something really good, I can go find where that was, buy it, and install it in my factory. They don't have an entrepreneurial class. That was destroyed during the early Mao years. So their entrepreneurial class that was vibrant in China in the 1920s has been purged from them that we have. You know, the United States has, Europe has, other parts of the world have. And so the growth has been really United States, parts of Europe maybe, but they're being drugged down by this huge behemoth of a war on their border. There's productivity growth in Africa. So just globally, Australia is doing fine, South Asia is doing fine, India is doing fine, but nobody's really doing quite as well as we are in terms of this productivity growth. Other places are getting, you know, Africa and China are getting growth because they're getting basic education under their belt. They're getting everybody, you know, you get to full literacy, you get really rapid growth. It's not about microcomputer chips. It's not about AI. It's not about that stuff. We're getting that. And if you read sort of the national reviews of that, you're beginning to see we were very worried that this remote work would lead to an outsourcing of jobs to Asia and elsewhere, particularly, you know, South Asia is great because English is a native language. Most everybody speaks it. And so they're very susceptible to a lot of outsourcing of jobs that might have otherwise been done by an American in a call center or something like that. You're beginning to see the reverse is true. European companies are now hiring American talent. So you can hire somebody in the United States. You don't have to. It's cheap to hire a remote worker. You buy them a computer. You give them some travel money. You check in on them. The randomized control trials that evaluate productivity show remote workers are more productive than in-place workers at a fraction of the cost. You don't have all the overhead of a facility, a phone line, downtown commercial real estate. You don't have to buy them a desk and all that other stuff. That's paid for by them in our tax system that subsidizes remote work through household deductions. So we're in that period where businesses can do surge applications. They need somebody 30 hours a week or 20 hours a week. They could hire a remote worker. Many remote workers have two or three of those jobs where they're working 10, 20 hours a week. They're getting the work done. Businesses are happy because they're cheaper. It's not as hard to fire or to have that sort of piecework. And technology, as you all know, just enables that in a way we've not seen anything like that in our labor market experiences. So that's a good thing. It also means places like Muncie or Kokomo or Richmond that maybe were really struggling to attract businesses, to hire people. Now they just need to attract people because people can then find work on their own somewhere else. So it's a geographic opportunity that we have not seen in East Central Indiana for a long time, and it's a happy story.
Media sector jobs are all going to start paying off.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I'm sorry about that.
How difficult was it to get AI to make Janet Yellen smile? Has anybody ever seen that before
today? That was funny. No. I mean, the AI is fun to work with. I've been using artificial intelligence 25 years. We use it in statistical modeling. You know, it's a way, just it's a fancy way. It's been around a long time. One of my best friends, when I got out of the Gulf War, he was a company commander, and he immediately was going there to do an artificial intelligence master's degree at Duke or something. And he's an infantry officer, so it's been around a long time. What's different about it now is there's so many potential applications that make work, make producing things easier. And the thing about AI that's different than, say, robotics on the factory floor is that for most of the people who use AI, that AI is complementing their work. It's not replacing it. And so you get artificial intelligence to complement the work you're doing. So if you complement, if you're now more productive because you're not having to do more routine, difficult things, then the demand for your labor goes up. You can produce more goods and services. So the story of technology is always it either complements, it replaces tasks, and either it replaces a task that complements that whole worker or that office, or it substitutes that task. And so it tends to be the better educated you are, it's a complement, and the worst educated, less well-educated you are, it's a substitute. So for people who are using AI to generate, I mean, it's funny to generate pictures, but the statistical modeling underlying our forecast was I did with maximum likelihood, which is a hill climbing algorithm that's our artificial intelligence. So that makes that work a lot more rapid. I couldn't have done 30 years ago, I couldn't have updated a forecast yesterday, not just because of computing power, but because the AI and the availability of that data made it so much more updatable. So doesn't mean my forecast is any more right than it would have been 30 years ago, but it means at least I had a chance to be intelligently wrong last night.
And AI is part of what would be feeding the increase in productivity.
Yes, yes. And AI is there's other things that we've seen happen that have not appeared in the data either. So statistical process control, you know, which is Lean Six Sigma and all that other stuff, we just have not seen that hitting the data over the past, you know, 10 or 15 years. We see it everywhere. You can't go to a factory that doesn't have a computer screen where somebody is operating and they're looking for, you know, some sort of defect in the production process. So instead of letting that product get all the way into the quality control inspector, their kit's being caught early. So the cost of that is fractional compared to what it would have been with even a very sophisticated process at the end. So I think we're in a different world right now. How long that persists, you know, these productivity bursts come, they're short, they make everybody better off for a while, and then they dissipate, and we go through another business cycle. But the underlying economy is very healthy.
So. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, guys.
Appreciate it. Nice to see you.
Yeah, good to see you.